Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tax season has arrived, and doing taxes without the right help can feel overwhelming. Intuit TurboTax is here now to guide you through it with confidence. Match with a TurboTax full-service expert who handles everything for you from start to finish. Your dedicated expert checks every single deduction and credit to help you get the best possible outcome so you can feel confident you're getting every dollar you deserve. And the best part? You'll see real-time updates on your expert's progress right on your phone while you live your life. Plus, you get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Visit TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Full Service Experts. Real-time updates only on iOS mobile app.
Hello and welcome to the Bullard Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. Delighted to welcome, for the first time to the show, reporter and co-founder at Dropsite News. His books include The Squad, and he's formerly with The Intercept, as well as suffering the indignity of working with Sam Stein at the Huffington Post. It's Ryan Grimm. What's up, man?
No indignity at all. Man, I'm jealous that you get to work with Sam. I miss my time with old Sammy.
It was about,
about a decade that we were partners in crime over there.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's like almost 10 years.
Time flies.
Yeah.
We got a lot to get to. I want to do a little bit of, like, at the end, just for the real sickos, some, like, you know, intra-Democratic Party narrative wars between the Liz Cheney's wing and the populist lefties. But unfortunately, the news gods have given us a bunch of sad shit to talk about. So first, yesterday morning during a nice encounter in Minneapolis, Renee Good, a 37-year-old mother, was murdered by an ICE agent. She was sitting in her Honda Pilot, waving officers by when three masked agents descended on her car, tried to open the door. They're shouting instructions at her. She tries to pull away. One of the agents draws down on her and shoots her three times in the head. She leaves behind three kids, including a six-year-old son who had previously lost his father and is now orphaned. I want to get into kind of the reaction, but just on the actual events of what happened, I was wondering what your thoughts were.
I've done a lot of police shooting reporting over the years, and this was sadly a very familiar scene, which is where you have a situation where a person is trying to comply, but tense, nervous, and angry officers are shouting contradictory orders at them. This happens, unfortunately, way too often. And in this case, if you look closely, you have one person saying, "Get out of the car," and pulling on her door handle. And then you have another officer saying, "Get out of here." And it's hard to, I think, put yourself in a place where you have masked armed men surrounding you and your situation has gone from 0 to 60, because as you said in the video, right before that, she was waving some ICE officers past her.
Yeah.
And then she's about to leave and then somebody kind of cuts her off. So she lets that person go. So she's waiting to exit this area. And then this other vehicle comes storming up. And the officer that killed her was not in that vehicle. He's kind of off to the side filming. And this is what really struck me. Did you notice this?
I didn't notice it till this morning. I'd seen this video like two times before we published yesterday and did a little commentary on it. You know, it was like the ninth time I was watching. I was like, wait, what is in his left hand?
He has his phone.
And it looks like I don't know if he's filming, but his phone is up.
His phone is out. He's either scrolling
yeah,
or filming. And it's so cold. You can tell from the video, it's so cold. He's got his bare hand. Yeah. One of those just phone addicts that is willing to get like hypothermia to have his phone out. And so there are a couple stills where you can see he's pointing the phone at the window, at the driver's window, while he's drawing his weapon. Like, set aside that you're not supposed to shoot at a moving vehicle for many obvious reasons.
Yeah, this is like the Department of Justice policy, by the way.
And all local agents. Police yeah. forces have it too, because shooting a driver of a car does not stop the car. Most people don't need to be trained.
Opposite, actually, in a lot of times.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It does the opposite. They usually, like, their foot hits the gas pedal and they accelerate. But there's no training manual that would say, oh, and also you should have your iPhone out in the other hand, like looking through your, like, just absolute rank amateur nonsense. Attorneys who have defended police officers in police-involved shooting cases have almost unanimously been coming out and saying, this is indefensible. Like, what I would try to do is cut some kind of a deal if this were my client. Like, the fact that she's turning the wheel, but also, like, why are they harassing this American citizen?
There's no reason for them to be
like,
there.
Who are they?
That's kind of why,
there's no authority to deal with her.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time, like, which I shouldn't have, probably getting in social media fights with people, like going through the frame by frame on all the stuff you just broke down. Mm-hmm. And being the most generous possible. Maybe it is possible that the officer that ended up shooting her, the agent that shot her, was scared in that moment. It does happen fast, but then the car does turn because she turned the wheel. Then he shoots her two times through the side window. Mm-hmm. when he's out of any danger.
Yeah.
The point I kept trying to make to people was like, it's stupid to even get into the frame-by-frame analysis argument. Like, what was happening right here? This is a 37-year-old woman in her Honda Pilot. You know, she's got stuffed animals for a kid sitting in the passenger seat. The car is not moving. It's stationary. And a bunch of masked officers, like, storm the car and start shaking her door. And then one of them draws their weapon. It's like there was no need for any of this, right? Like, she was not a dangerous criminal. It's not like they were like that. She was a suspect. And this is one of these tragedies where, like, you know, they were told that a murderer is in a Honda Pilot or something like this. And they converge on a car, right? She's not a criminal suspect. She's not even an undocumented immigrant. If that's the purpose of them being there, ICE, like, she is, I guess, maybe protesting. We don't know the whole backstory at this point about, like, what she'd been doing. But the car is not in any way a threat until these guys converge on it.
I think you're right that in some ways the frame-by-frame analysis is a trap, because it almost acknowledges, like, the legitimacy of what they're doing to begin with, and then says, well, but they made some mistakes here, and so that rises to, you know, some type of homicide. But no, like, they have no business confronting an American citizen on an American road, just going about her business. Like, leave her alone. Like, you don't have any business being there. Like, stop.
The administration's reaction is just unbelievably unconscionable. I just want to read through a couple of the things. The president said this: the woman driving the car was very disorderly, obstructing and resisting. She then violently, willfully, and viciously ran over the ICE officer, who seems to have shot her in self-defense. Based on the clip, it's hard to believe he is alive, but is now recovering in the hospital. So Trump said he's recovering in the hospital. This is, like, obviously not true. You watch the officer walk away. No. Vance this morning says every congressional Democrat should be asked a simple question. Do you think this officer was wrong in defending his life against a deranged leftist who tried to run him over? This is, again, this woman, American citizen, gets murdered. The vice president's now calling her names and making accusations about her motives without knowing anything. And then we had Kristi Noem dressed up as Indiana Jones yesterday in a press conference. Let's listen to that.
It was an act of domestic terrorism. What happened was our ICE officers were out in an enforcement action. They got stuck in the snow because of the adverse weather that is in Minneapolis. They were attempting to push out their vehicle, and a woman attacked them and those surrounding them and attempted to run them over and ram them with her vehicle.
That's just a totally hallucinated story. Like, that isn't even anything resembling what happened.
And it's also, what's this Keystone Cop nonsense of, like, getting your car stuck in the snow? Like, you're cops. Like, cops are supposed to be out helping people who can't handle inclement situations. Like, these are absolute amateurs. Like, so they started the traffic jam by getting their car stuck in the snow in Minnesota. Like, you were surprised that there was ice and snow in Minnesota? You don't have snow tires on your car in Minnesota? Like, if you have snow tires, you should not be stuck in the snow in Minnesota. So What are you doing? So you started this entire thing. Now you've created a traffic jam. It's chaos. She's waving people through. Instead of going through, you run up on her and surround her vehicle and give her contradictory orders and then shoot and kill her. If this was like, 2004 or something, and there was no video of this.
Right.
Like the lie in some ways is less offensive. It's more absurd because all of us know it's such a blatant lie. But like, imagine if we didn't have the video and all we had is eyewitnesses versus what Noma's saying. And Noma's saying she tried to ram them with her vehicle and she's a domestic terrorist. People would be like, wow, I guess, in such a situation, we know there are such things as car rammings that happens. This is terrifying. I feel for those officers. But then you see the actual video. It's like, no, it's a traffic jam that these idiots created that she's trying to get out of. And then they murdered her.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to quibble with you on it being less offensive, because for me, it's more offensive, because it's like,
interesting.
It's
just,
trying to make
it just washes
truth
over me.
Not like, what is truth? What right. is anything? You know what I mean? It is pernicious, right? This idea that like they can just make up a totally false story when we all have seen it. And that she's a deranged leftist. She's trying to ram them. There are a lot of right-wing accounts that are posting and coming out for me this morning and saying things like, well, the car is rolling up on them and they didn't say, what are they supposed to do? And I'm like, this is like one of those situations. The car is stopped.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, back when you were a teen, if it's one of those situations where like you're standing in front of your buddy's car, then they like hit the gas a little bit to, give you a little start. You're like, that's what this was, right? Like the guy easily
on
got
ice,
out of the way.
It's on ice. Like he could push the car backwards.
Right. Like the idea that this is not a car going 35 miles an hour, swerving at a cop, or a car that started and then presses the gas and jams across a parking lot, aiming at the cops. Right. Like this is a stopped car and they are yelling at her. And the idea that our government would like call this person names and smear them. It's not like this is unprecedented. Obviously, we went through this all before. It's a white woman. It's a little bit different than some of the past situations, but I don't know. It seems like especially egregious to me in this case.
Back when Sam and I were at HuffPost, we published a viral essay that described the term that comes from hip hop for this phenomenon. It's called fuckery.
Yeah.
It's when you tell a lie that you know is a lie, you know the person hearing it knows it's a lie, and they know that you know it's a lie. And it's a power move. Like it's beyond a lie.
Yeah.
Because a lie implies some attempt to deceive. In this case, there really is no intent to deceive because we can all see what happened. Fuckery is an expression of your power, the power imbalance. That I can say this completely outrageous thing, and all you can do is just like spit and like rage about it.
I like fuckery a lot better than gaslighting, if I'm just going to be choosing a word. It feels more on point. Yeah, I don't know, man. There's definitely fuckery happening from the administration, but I was pretty shook by like the amount of people, real people, not bots, people I know in my life on social media who are basically just like, yeah, she deserved it. Like, I'm sorry, if a cop tells you to do something, you should do it. I was thinking like, I was kind of shook when Charlie Kirk was killed. And like, there were a lot of people that were kind of like, well, he deserved it. He had what was coming to him. People in my life said that. It's been pretty, I should say, jarring to me that there are a lot of our citizens out there, a lot of people in the country, a lot of people in the political space who basically like think the punishment for not listening to a cop's orders in a stressful situation is that you should be summarily executed. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, on the psychological status of our fellow Americans, but it's pretty disturbing.
Extremely disturbing. That element of it is dark. Seeing people who you disagree with on some things, agree with on some things, defending the indefensible for no reason. Like, you don't have to do this.
Yeah. Her kid is orphaned. She has a 6-year-old orphan. Why are you doing this? Like, she didn't, you could just grab her license plate.
Right. When you're defending something that most police officers won't defend, you've taken a wrong turn. Like, any police officer who's gone through training watching that would say, none of that is how this should be done. This is an embarrassment to us. This is a shame. This person should be punished and prosecuted. To not agree with those police officers because you hate, and I think this is where the darkness comes in, they might not even agree with it. They just hate that woman so much that they don't care. Like a 37-year-old liberal poet, like who may or may not, like they assumed that she was like an observer at the protest. She may, I don't even know if that's true in this case, but that's what they believe, that she, this was a protester.
It seems like she probably was, but it doesn't matter. But.
Yeah. So like, let's say she was, they hate those people so much that they're okay, that they're glad that this was done to her. That's where the darkness, I think, is seeping in.
I have escalation concerns from all parties here, and I've seen people right to be rage. I'm fucking enraged. You know, I was living in Minnesota protesting. Mm-hmm. I saw some videos of protesters, for good reason, righteously shouting at some of these ICE and CBP officials. You know, one of those guys gets upset about that administration mm-hmm. cracking down, you know, reliving Kenosha or other things for 2020. Mm-hmm. There are some 2020 elements to this. This is January, not the summer, which is maybe in some ways going to tamp that down. But do you have concerns about escalations from all parties?
Yes, because we're early 2026 now. We're looking at 3 years at least.
A long way.
Until this term expires. Who knows what comes after that? Time is moving much more slowly than I think we would like it to. If we do believe we're going to move through this period. Yeah, this is a dark moment. And your point about DHS and the others like rallying around, you had people just immediately, and Trump, like immediately defending him rather than we're going to look into this. You know, we're going to let the investigation
play. Even Tom Holman, I should go to Minnesota.
Tom Holman was like, we're going to let the investigation play out.
Tom Holman is the moderate actor in this administration right now.
Right. Right. Yeah, when Tom Holman is a voice of reason, we're in a bleak place.
Now that the holidays are over, well, for the rest of you losers, we're into Mardi Gras season now in New Orleans. You might be feeling like you've got a big spending hangover, the drinks, the holiday food, the gifts, it all adds up. Luckily, Mint Mobile is here to help you cut back on overspending on wireless this January with 50% off unlimited premium wireless. Mint Mobile's end-of-year sale is still going on, but only until the end of this month, January. So cut out big wireless's bloated plans and unnecessary monthly charges with 50% off 3, 6, or 12 months of unlimited. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Okay, I'll tell you, we've been having a lot of convos here around, you know, as the kids get older, my friends, middle school kids, like, when is the appropriate phone time? For me, it's just one man's opinion. I'm going to be in, like, I want those kids to have a Nokia phone, like a little Snake. You know, you can play Snake on your phone. Or you can call your parents or your friends. That's it. For one of those kind of phones, Mint Mobile. Great idea. Been suggesting if some of my friends were looking into it. This January, quit overspending on wireless with 50% off unlimited premium wireless. Plans start at $15 a month at mintmobile.com/bulwark. That's mintmobile.com/bulwark. Limited time offer upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for a 12-month plan required. That's a $15 a month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Over 50 gigabytes. While it might slow when the network is busy. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com for details. I'll move on to a couple other things. I want to talk about Venezuela in particular. You guys wrote kind of analysis where you think things are from an admin policy and what's next for DropSite. Give us a little summary of what you think the state of play is.
It's a really bizarre situation, right? It's not a regime change operation. It's a president change operation, which, right. You know, ahead of time, there were people that were predicting that he would do something like this because he had built up such an armada and now had got himself stuck and had to climb down somehow. And so the only way out would be through. And those predictions seem to have been pretty on point. What he's doing right now with the oil is so bizarre. And in some ways, it's very, very Trumpian as well. Usually the United States, when it goes around the world extracting resources from people, does so with glossy language about democracy. So we'll say we're doing a great thing for people, and in fact, we're actually doing a pretty cynical thing for ourselves.
Though sometimes both.
Sometimes both, sure.
Sometimes a great, sometimes the cynical thing for ourselves is a great thing for people.
Sometimes.
Every once in a while.
In this case, it's the reverse in that they have so much oil stored and blocked because of U.S. sanctions and because of our blockade, you know, not allowing it out. They're in a crisis because they're making oil and they have nowhere to send it. This is an engineering crisis that we have created. And so they need to sell this oil. But we took their license, you know, took the Chevron license at the request of these South Florida members of Congress and you know, pushed by Rubio and his gang. And so now what he's doing is reinstituting that license without doing it. Like, the terms of this oil seizure are weird and unprecedented, and the money's going to go in offshore accounts before it goes to, like, pay the debts or this, that. But it is not that dissimilar fundamentally from what the terms would have been under the license. So Trump's saying we're going to steal all your oil, but what he's actually doing is kind of reissuing the license, but without issuing the license, because license implies like some type of law and regulation being followed. This is just gangster stuff. But for PDVSA, the oil company, this is a lifeline. Like, they need that oil out of their storage tankers. And Trump's saying they're going to sell it and split the proceeds, which is exactly what would happen under the licensing regime. If you then lift sanctions, because if Rubio is running the country and Trump is running the country, then why would you sanction Rubio?
And Trump said to the Times this morning, we might be running it for a few years.
Yeah. So got to lift the sanctions at that point, right? Yeah. So the South Florida crowd is actually very upset about all of this.
Right.
Because they're like, no. We don't want the U.S. running Venezuela. We want to run Venezuela.
Right.
But then that doesn't pass the sniff test for the American people, because it's like, what do you mean? Who's we? I thought we is the U.S. government. Aren't you Americans? And it's like, oh, no, you're not. You're like Venezuelan right-wing folks who want to like take the country back over. And then it exposes the entire scheme. Like, you and Rubio are trying to use the American government to settle your own scores over in Venezuela and Cuba, which nobody, like, that's not something the American people are on board for. American people, you want to steal the oil? Okay, fine. Now, and separately, Trump is destroying the domestic oil industry. Like, if you read the oil press the last several months and now accelerating, he's pushing supply so high because he wants to push oil prices down that it is making the Texas oil industry basically go bankrupt. This would be like the final nail in the coffin of the Texas oil industry.
Well, in theory, depending on how much oil we're actually taking out of Venezuela. I mean,
but even his pressure on OPEC to increase supply and drive down prices is killing the domestic shale industry.
It's having an impact, yeah.
Yeah, which is fascinating. I don't think he's doing it on purpose. He's just kind of an idiot.
No.
The same way the tariffs are destroying the farms and destroying American manufacturing. Like, I don't think he's trying to destroy American manufacturing. I don't think he's trying to destroy the American oil industry. But that's the consequence of his policies.
Is your takeaway from this that this is like a confluence of events where Marco has this ideological ambition and Stephen Miller wants to use it as an excuse for his immigration stuff, and Donald Trump is just likes will to power, you know, I just want to, you know, have the pictures for my TV show of this guy who attacked me, you know, in handcuffs, and it's kind of this one-off, and like, we'll see kind of how things stabilize? Or do you see this as part of a broader, you know, there'll be follow-ups on this?
It's Rubio. I think this was a unique historical circumstance where if Rubio himself, like if any other Secretary of State comes in, you probably don't get this. And also, Rubio was boxed out of Ukraine, Russia, and boxed out of Israel, Palestine.
Right.
People talk about all the work that he has. It's almost compensating for the fact that as Secretary of State, he's not actually involved in what were the two most important issues, those two. And so he was then able to just focus exclusively on his pet project, which is exercising the grievances of the South Florida Cuban community and the Venezuelan community and go after those countries.
Some legitimate grievances, very legitimate grievances, I would say.
Yeah, they're upset. Yeah, not our problem, if you ask me. Like, that's between y'all. Like, Why are we being asked to like settle these scores for you?
In MAGA world, there's a lot of fake grievances out there. So I sometimes, you know, like to distinguish between the imaginary made up grievances and the real grievances. That's all.
Yes, sure. But like they're un-American, they're non-American grievances. Like yeah, it's, sure. There are different, you know, beefs within the like Minneapolis Somali community between the, like that are literally organized around tribal beefs from back where they came to Somalia. Like imagine if they became so powerful as a lobby that they could then get the American military to go into Somalia and smash their rivals for them.
Yeah, that's good. That's
I think we'd be like, no, actually, like, yeah, I'm sure that like there were human rights abuses carried out against, you know, your family and your people there. Yeah. And I don't really want to get into all the details because like they've got their side of the story too. We're not going to send the American military to Somalia to like enact your vengeance.
Adjudicate that.
But like doing it on behalf of South Florida, Cuban and Venezuelans is like just an acceptable use of the American military for whatever reason. And then the second thing is the obvious one, which is like China is a rising power and we're backing off our global hegemony. So we're focusing on what we call our backyard, which is such a weird term. It's not our backyard. These are our neighbors. Like imagine if you called your neighbor's house your backyard.
It's not even really my neighbor. I mean, it'd be like me talking about people in Shreveport and saying there, that's my backyard. I have deep concerns about what's happening in Shreveport. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Shreveport be like, yeah, this is not your backyard. Right. You're welcome to visit. Yeah. Like, and hang out and like come watch a game.
Let's talk about something no one wants to talk about. What happens when you die? That's brutal. I don't know. It's not really true for me. My mother loves talking about death. My mother is just very comfortable talking about death. It's a good Catholic trait. So I'm okay. I'm good on talking about death. It's not the best. You know, you get emotional, but I'm happy to talk about it. But for some folks, it's a little uncomfortable. You know, you don't think about it happening to you. But it's still important to be prepared for it. With Trust and Will online real estate planning, you can do exactly that. I took a look at it, and it's super easy to use. You can create an estate plan with Trust and Will in as little as 30 minutes. Trust and Will's online platform provides a step-by-step guided process. They offer optional one-on-one support from attorneys in your state. Trust and Will believes estate planning should be accessible to everyone, so they're committed to making it affordable today and valuable tomorrow. They also have amazing customer support with real people, not AI chatbots. So don't wait until it's too late. Protect your loved ones today, tomorrow, and beyond with Trust and Will, the most trusted name in online estate planning. Go to trustandwill.com/bulwark and get 20% off. That's trustandwill.com/bulwark to get your 20% off. Trustandwill.com/bulwark. I want to talk about the political, like what this says about what's happening on the right. You've kind of lived at this nexus of the horseshoe, if you will, with breaking points. People don't know it. Has kind of, it's hosts that are kind of populist righties, populist lefties, essentially, for shorthand. Yeah. Also some other some people with weird heterodox politics in there as well. But the part of the populist right that has been kind of rising is folks that are rhetorically saying, you know, sounding a lot like how you just sounded. We shouldn't care about stuff that's happening over there. I don't care about tribal conflicts in the Middle East or Africa or South America for that matter. And we shouldn't out with the neocons. And there's been some common cause. You know, we've seen people like Glenn Greenwald as a populist lefty become like very friendly with the populist right crowd on MAGA media. And now we're a year into the Trump administration where he was supposed to be kind of representing that populist right foreign policy. And you know, we're bombing people everywhere, basically. Yeah. And we just deposed a leader in Venezuela. And it has revealed some strains of people that were legitimate in that view. But a lot of these folks, you know, have turned out to be fake. And one of them was a Daily Wire guy named Matt Walsh, who's on your show talking about how he is
non-interventionist
by nature. But also he's like really thrilled that we're fucking up Venezuela. So you're living in this world even a little more than me, actually.
Yeah.
How do you assess that kind of strain of what's happening on the right?
With the Matt Walsh strain, I think there's like a macho element to his politics that is going to like dominate over whatever claims he has to non-interventionism, where they're saying they're against previous wars that didn't go well. Like Vietnam, bad, you know, didn't go well. Iraq, bad, didn't go well. Afghanistan, bad, didn't go well. We should not be in these forever wars that we're not winning. But you show them like a military adventure that like, that you go in, you do some, you bang, bang, and you get out. They're like, oh, that's great. Like they're for military adventures that they think are working, which is not a, that's not a principle. That's just being a thug.
Well, in part because you can't predict what's going to work and what's not going to work. Libya looked great at the beginning, you know, for example.
Yeah, Saddam Hussein fell in like 3 days or something.
Right. Ukraine looked terrible, on the other hand, for the Ukrainians, right? Like for the first couple of days, right? And, you know, it was conventional wisdom that Russia was going to run roughshod over them. So, you know, that shows the limits of that kind of mindset.
Right. And then you've got people like Tulsi Gabbard, who just did pure cynical power plays. Like,
where is she? Have you heard from her? You and Tulsi are pals. Is she?
She doesn't respond to me anymore. I covered her first congressional campaign, so I knew her before she was even in Congress in like 2014, and she was a very strident and principled opponent of like regime change wars. Now, the fact that she always qualified it as regime change wars and was always comfortable with basically drone campaigns against what she saw as like Islamist forces and her links with like right wing Modi folks who are like virulently hostile to all Muslims, basically. That was always like a red flag in her politics. I think she finally said something about Venezuela where she figured out some way to applaud the thing that she, like, she's the classic case because you can go back and find all of these posts, 2019 slamming Trump for trying to do a coup in Venezuela. There's a Tulsi tweet for everything. There is a warmonger and a isolationist faction in both parties, and they're jockeying for position constantly throughout history.
I guess my question is, on the right, is it even possible for the isolationist side of the party to ever truly succeed? I guess my point is, there's just something about the nature of being a right-wing party that, sure, like you could move away from the type of foreign engagement that Bush and Reagan and others engaged in because you don't care about democracy abroad, et cetera, et cetera. But it does feel like there's some, you use the word machismo. It's just something about the strain of kind of a will to power, right wing nationalist. Like it's kind of hard to imagine at the end of the day them ever being fully pacifist as well.
Right. When the chips are down, it's very difficult, I think, on the right to stand up for the, like, let's not do this war.
Right.
But there are people, no, the American conservative, for instance, like they've consistently the last couple of years, like really pushed hard against that, you know, that magazine has pushed hard against the stuff. And
but like, look who's in the administration. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not Kurt Mills.
Right. And J.D. Vance was like their lead champion. Like he was their guy. And he's just completely defanged in all of this.
One of the things, and this kind of gets us into a couple of different topics. So like one of the groups that bought into that was kind of this like manosphere, comedian, culturally right kind of podcast universe, however you want to describe that.
Right.
And they bought in to like Trump as being a non-interventionist candidate. And they also were, in most cases, like following the Epstein stuff very closely, which you guys have been following. You went on one of those shows recently, Tim Dillon, which is what inspired me to invite you over here. I was like, fuck, if he's going to be on the Tim Dillon show, we gotta expose him to the Bullock audience. But so I want to talk about kind of both, like how that intersects with both those worlds. And when you're talking to Dillon, like, do you think, well, actually, let's table the foreign policy side of this. Let's talk about the Epstein side of this first. Like, did you sense that, like, that world is really starting to become disillusioned with Trump over the Epstein stuff and that you think that there's something there?
Extremely, extremely. Because these are also the kinds of people who don't really believe that the government is going to deliver materially, you know, for people.
Right.
Somebody like a Rogan, and I don't actually know Dillon's, like Tim Dillon's domestic politics, but like, you know, Rogan, you ask him, he's for like Medicare for all, he's for higher minimum wage. He supported Bernie in 2020, and now he's drifted right. So I don't know where he stands with that stuff now, but he's also very American in the sense he's very cynical that the government is actually going to deliver on those things. And maybe he's right. Like maybe that cynicism was grounded in something. But what that means is that giving us the Epstein stuff and doing those things, that's what they want, because that they're like, you can actually do that. Like, well, I don't think you're going to lower, you know, healthcare costs. I don't think you're going to actually reverse climate change. You're not going to do any of this stuff. You should, but you won't. But you have the files.
Yeah.
You ran on transparency and against pedophilia. Because that's the other thing. Like, you know, these aren't QAnon people, but the QAnon vibe around, like, there are these, this is a cabal of pedophiles that are like running the world. Like, that's seeped into broadly MAGA. A lot of MAGA wouldn't adopt the whole QAnon thing. They might not even know what Q is. But that idea that these reptiles are running the world has purchase. And so it's like, okay, you're not gonna do anything to necessarily make the world and my life better, but you're gonna expose these reptiles. Like, you're gonna lock up the pedophiles. Or at least you're going to shame the pedophiles, even if you're not gonna prosecute them. And so to have that, which is the thing that they actually thought he was gonna do, to see him become an obstacle to that, I think is extremely demoralizing and for many of them, radicalizing, taking them not to just a place of ambivalence around Trump, but like deep hostility. And then embarrassment too.
Embarrassment, I think, is key. Embarrassment.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, you know, they have listeners too. They see the feedback, see the comments, right? Like, they've been promising this, you know, and like in MAGA world, you get away from the embarrassment because you can just be like, oh, well, the other guys are bad. You know, you get straight back into team sports if you're like a Fox News wing, or, you know, but they don't have that.
Right. They don't have that.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Let's just talk about the Epstein stuff more broadly, and then we'll get back to the politics, because you've been going through these files really closely. What's your sense for what we've learned from the limited amount of information we've got that is new or maybe different from what, you know, maybe conventional wisdom would be from people who are only kind of following this lightly?
Ironically, I think what we're discovering probably actually affirms people's conventional wisdom around this. Because I think people assumed that this was a guy who operated in the gray area of the kind of the elite political economy as an asset for various intelligence services. That was kind of the assumption about him.
I mean, in certain parts of the universe, though, there are other places that they would say that's crazy, like that he is an intelligence asset. Right. That's a conspiracy theory.
Right. New York Times readers. Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty big audience.
Yeah, it's a very big audience. But for the, like, what I think of now as the centrist person, which who has like wildly eclectic politics and listens to like Joe Rogan or Tim Dillon, like That to me is the actual American center. Not you. Like you're not like you yeah, are no. kind of, I think, like for Washington, like the epitome of like a centrist or center leftist.
This is such a good point. I always like whenever I do like a panel with rich people, which I tried to do as little as possible because I hate them. Mm-hmm. But whenever I mm-hmm. do for whatever reason, like the question, like always the first or second question is like, why can't we have a center party that is like somebody like you? That's like socially moderate and fiscally conservative. And I'm just like, those people do exist right now. They're just Democrats. Mm-hmm. Like that's the governor of a couple mm-hmm. states, like for starters. And like B, like if you were to get a third party center person, they would be who you hate. Like they'd be the opposite of you, right? Yes. Like they would be somebody that is socially kind of conservative and fiscally a little Bernie mm-hmm. flavoring. And right. Yeah. I mean, I agree with your political assessment on that total.
And so for that type of person, I think they assumed, I guess you could call it a conspiracy theory, but I think they just assumed that that's who this guy was. Like that's what they sniffed on him, is that there's no way he gets away with all of this stuff and has all these major connections without some type of relationship. And how that relationship was defined remains a mystery. But what we find in his correspondence in particular are, you know, deep ties to Israeli government figures and American intelligence figures. Like it doesn't mean he's like getting a W-9 from the CIA. But like,
he's not like on staff for Mossad necessarily.
That's not how it works. Like, he also has his own personal agendas that are overlapping, and he's a figure within this Davos set, and he is at times deploying Mossad or his own assets, like in the American government, for the benefit of himself or his allies. I think people looking for like a room where global strategy is like set and then executed upon, and him being like taking notes there and being part of it, that's not how the world is organized. The world is organized around these competing factions of oligarchs and elites who wax and wane in their power within that set. And he kind of swam in that world and did so since the 80s.
This stuff is all kind of murky and gray, but I'm going to try to kind of create a line between what I think is maybe conspiracy mongering and true a little bit, right? Like on the conspiracy side of the line is like the mm-hmm. sort of puppet master thing, like the puppeteer theme, right? Where there is a government, whether it be the US or mm-hmm. Israel or France, if you're Candace Owens, right? That it's like puppet mastering him and like telling him, you go after this guy and you mm-hmm. co-opt them and then blackmail them because we need that. I don't think mm-hmm. we have a lot of evidence for that yet.
We don't have that. No.
Yeah, no evidence for that. And then the other side of the line is like this kind of human frailty that does seem to be particularly common among the kind of elite networking set, right? Which is if somebody says that they can do a solid for you, you kind of look the other way, you know, about their, mm-hmm. you know, behavior, even if that behavior is like disgusting.
Or especially if you've engaged in that behavior with him.
Right. So now this is where the gray area parts of the line. Right. And that's what I think has been frustrating about the release. It's like, okay, but who are the other guys that have engaged in the behavior? You know, because like Peter Thiel is on these emails, you know, with him on the networking side of it. Based on what I know about Peter Thiel, I don't think he was raping young girls. You know what I mean? And so
I think we can safely acquit him of those charges. Yes.
Right. So some of the people are on these emails, I assume, are raping young girls. And some of them just like the fact that this is a rich guy who's giving them favors. What have we learned?
I think what people need to understand and add to their understanding of who Epstein was that he was able to deliver material benefits to his allies that were not raping young girls. Like if you wanted, like Ehud Barak, for instance, when he, as he's leaving the Ministry of Defense, Epstein gets him $2 million bonus, $1 million retainer with Renova Group, the Victor Vexelberg's, who's a giant oligarch and close ally of Putin. Like he gets him that deal and he helps get him like $1 million from Wexner to not write like a memoir. So if you're Ehud Barak, like he delivered that for you. He even set up Barak with a meeting with Sarkozy, set up Barak with a meeting with Putin after Epstein himself declining a meeting with Putin because Putin wanted to meet him on the sidelines of this conference. He's like, no. If Putin wants to meet, it's got to be in his palace and we need like 90 minutes. We've got serious business to talk about. Like that's the level of guy that we're talking about, like chiding world leaders. And he bailed on the Sarkozy Ehud Barak meeting. It was in Paris. They're having dinner. Last minute, he's like, I don't feel well. You guys go. And that's where the disgusting like layer of his life gets into. What do you think he did in Paris instead that night? I think he was feeling fine. I think he wanted to do something else.
Yeah, right.
But the point is that because he was this like college dropout, fired from Bear Stearns, that not really a tax guy, yet giving all this tax advice, people are like, he's not doing anything of professional value to these people. So therefore, the only thing he can be doing is like delivering them young girls. And what we found in his correspondence, that's not true. Like he had deep ties with all of these shadowy networks. And if you were somebody who wanted to operate in a gray area, which is most of these elites, he was helpful to you. How many people in the world can get you a meeting with, you know, the president of France, the president of Russia, or the former president of the United States? Like, there are not a lot of people who have that level of Rolodex and ability to get people to respond to them. So I think the fact that he was engaging in this foul behavior with so many men meant that they implicitly knew that if something went south, he had dirt on them. Or if he asked them for something, like they should probably just go ahead and do it because they know what he's got. Yet, you don't even need that to explain a huge amount of what he was able to accomplish, because he was making these people rich and getting them meetings that were leading to security agreements that were even like state level security agreements between Israel and Cote d'Ivoire, Israel and Mongolia, or these Nigerian diamond mines. He's like getting things done for people. And I think that has been missing from the understanding of Epstein. And when you understand that, then you can maybe contextualize the sex trafficking a little differently.
So it takes us to the cover-up and the question of, you know, whether this is just a straight Donald Trump, there's embarrassing information about him in there. Mm-hmm. Like the degree to it is unknown, but obviously he was engaged in gross behavior with Epstein at some level. And he's like on the, you know, it's like, oh, we've learned at least he's on the plane more times than he said. He lied about how many times he's on the plane, that he's on the plane with a girl who was a victim of Maxwell's, right? There's only four of them on the plane. So the cover could just be straight Trump, right? Or when you tie it into the security services conversations, are other people out there that kind of say, well, no, I mean, the cover up is related to that, and right? Mm-hmm. Like the CIA and who the hell knows, BB and Sarko, who knows, like is leaning on Trump as well and saying, no, bro, you got to hold the line here on this. Like, where do you fall on that?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, and Melania knew Epstein as well.
What do we know about that? I've not followed the Melania Epstein line that closely, if I'm being candid.
We know that they knew each other. She's very litigious. I think we can leave it at that.
but can we do one more sentence between that and litigiousness?
I don't know. I don't think I want to do any more sentences on that in particular.
Okay.
We're working on some angles, and you know when we know more. But there's been some contention about whether or not Epstein was the one who introduced them. There's other people who say, no, actually somebody else introduced Melania and Trump. And she also knows that world of like exploitative modeling from her own experience in it.
Which they both engaged in. Again, when you're talking about the bad things that Trump did, like the exploitative modeling, something both Trump and Epstein.
Exactly. Yeah. And also the part that makes me think there's got to be other people leaning on him is that he's very hard to shame.
Yeah.
Like this is a guy who bought Miss Teen USA and went on Howard Stern to say like he bought it so that he could like creep on these teen girls naked in their locker room.
Yes.
Like he said that out loud with the cameras running.
Yeah.
He wasn't joking.
No, and the teen girls in the locker room have testified that he did that.
Right.
That he did what he said.
Exactly. Yes. They have said like, and his daughter, they asked Ivanka, and she's like, yeah, like that's the kind of thing he does. So at that point, you're like, what mystery is left to how this guy interacts with teen girls? You know, what more is going to embarrass him? You know, he also has a virtue of often being like open about how he's thinking. When he was asked during the campaign if he was going to release the, you know, the Kennedy files and the Epstein files, he was like, I think we should definitely release the Kennedy files and we should release the MLK and RFK.
Moon landing.
And
then
I think it was on NPR somewhere. And so they followed up and they're like, notice that you didn't, Ledger's a little short there. What about the Epstein one? And he's like, you know, there's a lot of people are in there. There's going to be some guilt by association, and not everybody in there did something wrong, and it's going to be embarrassing for people. Like he even during the campaign, he was giving this rationale for why he didn't want to release all of the Epstein files, while saying like Epstein's a creep. I never liked him. We've had a falling out. I think you should take him seriously in that when he says that like he's trying to protect people whose names are in there and who he knows.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Are you a fraud-paying American? It's a fact that one in four honest, hardworking, tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. With LifeLock Identity Theft Protection, though, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, and get you your money back. Last year, the IRS flagged over $16 billion in refunds for identity fraud. That's billions of dollars that could come from your salary, overtime, or second job. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. And if your information does fall into the wrong hands, only LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists who are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
I want to do some white people discourse with two white guys. Is that okay? Can we do some little white people discourse?
Representation matters. We have the right white people here, right?
I'm going to tie two items together that are in the news. And I just want to say very clearly up front, I'm not creating an equivalence between these two people. I just want to talk about two news items in the context of identity politics and the dangers of identity politics from my point of view. Are you ready for this? Okay, here we go.
Elon Musk. We'll see where you're going with this.
The biggest donor to the president, one of the richest men in the world, is owner of X.com. He posted this morning, or maybe overnight. Seems like he might have been on a ketamine binge. I don't know, allegedly. He writes this, or someone else writes this. If white men become a minority, we will be slaughtered. Remember, if non-whites openly hate white men while white men hold a collective majority, then they will be 1,000 times more hostile and cruel. When they are a majority over whites, white solidarity is the only way to survive. Elon Musk posted that with like a 100 sign. Totally agree. Mm-hmm. So that's where Elon Musk is. He wants white solidarity, the white South African.
Yep.
We'll just start there and just have a brief sentence. That's very bad and alarming. You concur with that?
It's an 1850s like Southern white. We should end slavery, but if we do, they'll kill us all. Like it's that level of like fear and projection too.
It's 1950s South Africa, maybe also
1980s. While he was in school,
I was
there,
trying to parallel.
He's bringing the Afrikaner, the bad elements of Afrikaner. Then turned out that wasn't true, by the way, even in South Africa. Like
white solidarity is the only way to survive. This was the top donor to the president. That's pretty alarming. So that's bad. There's also a scandal going around around one of Zohran's staffer, much less prominent person, but I just want to use this story as kind of a way to talk about something I have concerns about. C.L. Weaver's her name. Mm-hmm. She was posted to a housing role in the Mandani administration. We have a milkshake duck situation where they go back through all of her past Twitter accounts, something I'm generally not that fond of, but she wrote a bunch of things about whites. She's white. She writes, private property is a weapon of white supremacy. I endorse a no more white men in office platform. We should impoverish the white middle class. Home ownership is racist. I wish I believed in God, so I believe that all white men who take credit for the work of women of color would one day burn. I came across a mob of 11-year-old white boy children. I don't know why we keep procreating. Delta should kick all white people in Christmas outfits off planes. All right, that one's funny. I'm not saying that it's Sia Weaver's fault that Donald Trump's top donor and advisor is a white supremacist. I'm not. But I think that we get into a very dangerous spot sometimes with folks on the left who get very comfortable in the identity politics space and then start just throwing around pejoratives about white people all the time. And I think that it's right to be a little judicious about this, both because we're in a pluralistic society and it's just wrong, but also because the backlash, I don't think we want to encourage white identity politics. And I think that we want to disencourage that as much as possible. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
That certainly does encourage white identity politics, which I don't think anybody other than Elon Musk and his fans like think is a good idea.
Yeah. Or Nick Fuentes. Maybe, unfortunately, there's a growing number of people actually who think it's a good idea. And so I think that's why it's very important to be conscious of trying to disincentivize it as much as possible.
Yeah. And the left took like several wrong turns to find themselves in this place where they're like attacking 11-year-old white children. You probably need to retrace your steps at that point and figure out how you got there. And one way they got there was, you know, this academic jargon taking over the left and the idea of white supremacy as a structuring force of society being kind of divorced from whiteness itself, like that, you know, things could become white, how the Irish became white, how the Italians become white, how whoever.
Yeah, sure.
That non-white people can like become white because whiteness is not actually a racial structure anymore. It stands in for the oppression of people within American society. So you've got that academic argument, which then you get loose with, and then you start just talking about white in this, because now you've defined like the structure that you're against as white. You've tried to explain in your seminar that you don't actually mean white. It can be lots of other things that fall under this rubric. And then you start doing what she's doing, which is like going after like actual like individual white people or 11-year-old white boys. And you can trace backwards how you got there, but you should probably like head out and take a different turn, even if it's just pragmatically for the reason that you're talking about.
But also just because it's like a moral and ethical framework, we should just judge people as individuals. Individuals. And I just think if you get into a space where you're getting reckless with doing pejoratives about people, like based on their group identity. And obviously like white people can have a thick skin. As a white person, I could say we can have a thick skin, but it's just, you know, I mean, it's a lot. It becomes a lot.
Yeah. What are you going after the 11-year-old white boys? Come on. What were those kids doing? Like now, on the other hand, middle schoolers in general are awful.
11-year-old boys can be tough.
Yes.
You have some experience with that.
It's like, I get it.
I'm not there yet.
But come on.
I'm about to be coaching a 7-year-old girls team, and I'm very excited about that. That'll be much chiller.
But so anybody who was a millennial or trying to act like one, you know, throughout, starting in the 14-ish, but like accelerating in like 2020 up into, say, 2022 or 3, is going to have all sorts of like bananas posts, including Mayor Mamdani. And so I do think it's an interesting moment where I think there's an argument for Mamdani, or let's say, see, we were like, I think it'd be fine to say, look, this is embarrassing and this is, I don't actually hate white people. But then Mamdani's standing behind the person and being like, look, we all said a lot of crazy things and we're not going to eliminate everybody from public life who said crazy things during, you know, the late teens and early 20s, because that's the entire like left, everyone for the most part.
Okay. Well, do you feel like there's been enough of a reckoning within the left part of the left about that? I mean, what you just said that's a pretty common opinion among like center left abundance bros, right? What you just laid out, right? Was that like a lot of people got kind of crazy in 2019 and started saying too much identity stuff. Mm-hmm. We should stop doing that.
Right.
But on the left of the left, I don't hear people saying that quite as explicitly. And I think it's a potential danger. I think if I was a populist leftist or a squad person, I'd be like AOC's I could crush an AOC presidential campaign. I mean, her like rhetoric kind of weaves back and forth between more of a Bernieist, you know, kind of populist left, culturally neutral. And then she goes through phases where she starts sounding very identitarian, you know, woke, ultra woke, you know, if you're watching some of her old clips.
Yeah. And on that point, then I proudly bear the scars from being somebody who's was on the left throughout that period. I mean, people can search and try to prove me wrong. I did not do that. And I pushed back pretty consistently against it. And if I had it to do over again, I would push back even harder than I did, even though, you know, back before Musk bought Twitter, I was getting dragged multiple times a week for like pushing back against this kind of thing. I even remember I defended in 2013, this poor young lady told a joke about AIDS in Africa. She'd lived in Africa for years. And she tweeted.
Justine or something? Or she's on a
Sacco,
plane.
Justine like, Sacco. Yes, yeah. Justine Sacco.
Is that right? Why am I wasting my brain on that knowledge instead of like learning Mandarin? Ago.
Yes. She tweeted, I'm going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. She was satirizing the like a provincial racist American.
Yeah, right.
And then didn't have service until she landed in Africa. And was a global name by the time she landed, fired from her job. And I remember I even defended her at the time. Like, guys, you're being idiots. She was telling a joke about racist provincial Americans.
So do you worry about that, though, just as a political item, that like the squad types haven't really embraced that?
I don't think there's been a reckoning. I think there's been a Homer quietly walking back into the hedges.
Got it.
And there has been some reckoning. Like, after... And I saw that on the rundown you had the story I did in 21 or 22, whatever it was, about the elephant in the Zoom, about all of these.
This is we're running out of time already, but this is such a good story. So I'll just put a link in it, but in the show notes, so people can go read it. But yeah, it was from 3 years ago. It was about how these activist groups, basically all the infighting over various woke arguments.
They were imploding over this kind of thing, and they were weaponizing this language for their own internal grievances. And so there was a reckoning there among organizations of like, how do we continue to be an organization? Like, how does more than one person function collectively together? Because if they can't, like, there's no left. So there's been some reckoning, but nowhere near enough. But yet, on the other hand, I actually think Mamdani should like hold the line. If you start firing these people.
Yeah, I agree. Don't give scalps.
Right.
Yeah, don't give scalps into this. I mean, I don't know anything about this person. Maybe she was a bad hire and would not be good for other reasons, but like, you know, not over this.
I've heard great things about her, like, other than the, like, you know, mouthing off crazy anti-white stuff.
Which sounds great. Okay. I have a whole list of things I want to argue with you about, but fucking an ICE agent shot a woman inside a car, which is something we passionately agree about. So we're going to have to do a... We're gonna have to take a little whatever rain check to argue later about YIMBYism or various things. But can we just do 2 minutes on Liz Cheney discourse? Because I have to do it with you. Can we do two minutes on this?
Where are you on Liz Cheney? Like,
so here's what I get very frustrated with. Okay, this is and for folks who are not very online, it's been a great show. We'll see you back tomorrow. I've got some great guests lined up. For folks who are very online, there's like this argument between kind of the establishment or whatever, Democrats and like the left populist types where you spend a lot of time, where like a big criticism of the Kamala campaign was that she allowed Trump, going back to this where we were at the top, she allowed Trump to get to the left of him on her on foreign policy. This is part of the argument I agree with, and that she allowed for, and the Democrats broadly allowed for like the Tim Dillons and Joe Rogans of the world and all of the people they represent, just regular people that don't want war throughout the country, to believe wrongly that he was going to be the peace candidate, and that a series of choices reinforced that. That narrow argument, I agree with. And I wasn't saying this at the time, so I'll just say I'll throw myself on the mercy of the court. I was wrong about that. I should have been saying that, I think, more clearly at the time. But I think that obviously, like, Trump was able to pull the wool over people's eye on this. The area where I get in disagreement is, part of the reason Trump was able to pull the wool over people's eyes, because a lot of big prominent people on the left were going along with his fake bullshit argument. And I get very defensive and get my back up when it's like Liz Cheney and me and my fellow Never Trumpers and Bill Kristol and whatever. We did everything we could to help Kamala win because we saw Trump for who he was. And we're just like, put me in, coach. You know, Liz Cheney wasn't like, I need to be in the cabinet and Kamala must support bombing the Middle East for me to be on her campaign. It's a litmus test. Liz Cheney was like, I support Kamala Harris. And I know personally from being behind the scenes that like the Harris campaign didn't even call Liz Cheney for months. And she just like endorsed her and just, and then eventually at the end of the campaign, they made a strategic decision to have an event with her. But like all the folks that came from more of a interventionist side recognized Trump for the threat that he was, opposed him, tried to help. And a lot of people on the left spent the whole campaign pissing in the tent. And then at the end of the campaign, they're like, fucking Liz Cheney's fault. And I'm over here going, no, it's fucking your fault, Hassan, for saying that they were going to be the same. And it's your fault, like other Glenn Greenwald for going on Fox and shitting on like, and you know, this was all predictable. We all knew who Trump was. So anyway, now you see me getting my blood pressure up. So I'm wondering, I would like for you to adjudicate that dispute between me and your brethren.
All right. So the counter argument would be, well, and I don't blame Cheney for being Cheney either. Like blaming a leopard for being a leopard. It's Kamala for putting her on stage who would be the one to blame. And who you put on stage matters. So here would be the counter argument. If you talk to, and you know Waleed Shahid, I'm sure.
I do know Waleed.
Like, yep. You probably know other people who are involved in the uncommitted movement in Michigan. This was a very precise, strategic move that was criticized on the left for being too friendly and too open to the Democratic Party, because what they were, and they have said this very publicly, they have said, we cannot deliver for you these left anti-war votes just by virtue of our charisma. Like, Waleed is an amazing person, but him just going on Twitter and saying, please vote for Kamala Harris because I, Waleed, say that you should, is not actually going to deliver those votes. He needs, and the people that he was allied with, need something to tell them, something, like some argument that he can make that she is better when it comes to foreign policy and in particular Gaza than Trump will be. Because Trump is saying things that some people can glom onto and say he's going to be better. And so they came up with this idea. They're like, how about you give a Palestinian American lawmaker a 2-minute speech at the DNC that is vetted by you and that is supportive of Kamala Harris? How about you do that? If you do that, then that gives us a way to say, look, you don't like everything she stands for, but we're in the tent. She's listening to us. And so we can fight for the change that we want when she's in office. The speech, you can find the speech. It's online. Here's the speech. It's slobbering over Kamala the whole time by a Georgia state lawmaker who's Palestinian American. And she said no. And gave nothing else. Like, okay, you're not doing that. Like, okay, what? Give us something here that we can tell people whose sole issue here is ending this genocide. Give us something. And they decided to give nothing. In fact, every time she was asked about it, she would lead with a long recitation of October 7th. Like at the time I could verbatim give you her answer every single time she was asked about it. And that was the decision that she made.
I agree with the decision. I agree with you. I agree with the critique. She should have let that person speak. She should have let the Georgia lawmaker speak. I've since texted with that lawmaker and she should have let her speak.
What was she thinking?
I also just think fundamentally, like, Liz Cheney didn't speak at the convention, and she didn't go with a list of demands that I want a pro-life activist to be on stage at the convention before I support you. Like, at the end of the day, she went out and gave speeches that was like, Donald Trump is a great threat. And at the end of the day, there was not a lot of folks from that uncommitted movement and from the left who are prominent who are out there saying, you know what? You know who Donald Trump's best buddy is? Bibi. And this sucks. And I hate that Kamala is doing this. And I wish that we had done this and that. But like, we have no choice here. Like, you have to vote for her because Donald Trump is about to turn Gaza into fucking, you know, high rise buildings and let Israeli settlers do whatever they want in the West Bank and blah, blah, blah. And that wasn't right, that. They didn't do that. They didn't do that. Instead, they're like, ah, sorry, Liz Cheney's fault. And
because that wouldn't have landed with people because Netanyahu is already doing that. Like, Netanyahu is doing it. So, like, I'm sorry they won't let a Palestinian speak. Sorry they won't make any commitments to doing anything differently than Biden. Anything. Even Kamala says she was wrong on that score.
Yeah, no, she was obviously wrong on that. I asked her that when I interviewed her. I was like, why didn't you distance from him more?
Yeah, if you elect Trump, XYZ terrible thing is going to happen. If XYZ terrible thing is already happening, that's my point. Like, you could have surrogates who would go out and say that. But it's not going to land for people who are watching it like in real time unfold on their phones. And so, yeah, that's why we get the, well, I guess we need to buy TikTok and, you know, have Instagram censor everything. So my point is, like, even if like Hassan Piker is out there begging people to vote for Kamala.
Would have been a try, I guess. I hear you. I hear you. I'm just saying that, like, sitting in my boat, it's like I would get calls all the time from Politico reporters who are like, what are the demands of the Never Trump movement on Kamala? And I was like, nothing. Win. That's the demand. And like, I don't, you know, there might have been a handful of, might have been two or three commentary writers who, or whatever, who are extremely pro-Israel that would have abandoned her if she said that. But like, Liz wasn't going to. You know what I mean? Like, the people that were supporting her weren't going to because we were supporting her because we didn't like Trump. And so I get frustrated by that.
So then, yeah, it's mystifying to me, like, how she didn't see the importance of it, given the stakes. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates has said it better, which is that it's all a proxy for this. If you won't stand against genocide, how do I trust you to stand up for democracy? Like, and that's the point. Like, you have to convince people that you are worth voting for. And you have to do something to earn that. It's a fact that there are people in the country that need to be convinced. Like, you could say that you don't that they should already be convinced by the terribleness of the opponent. But it is a fact.
I do feel that's how I feel.
That is how you feel. That's how I feel. And throughout history, there's a chunk of people who do not fit in that category. There always will be. And you can't hector them to be otherwise. You have to either decide, okay, I'm going to try to do something that will win their votes, or I will find votes elsewhere. But just like wishing that those kinds of people don't exist is not going to do it.
Yeah. I'm not wishing they don't exist. I just think that the people that were that influence.
I just think you're overstating their influence. I genuinely think you're overstating their influence and ability to change those people's minds.
But then I think the counter is true. Like, sure, maybe I'm overstating their influence, but then simultaneously, like, doing one event with Liz Cheney where they had a round table or whatever when she didn't even speak, also overstates. Like, I sometimes feel like, okay, really? Like, what's Liz Cheney's name ID in the country? 30%? Right. Like, it was like, you know, that was the thing. And also, you know what I mean? So I think that it could work. That cuts.
We embed symbolism in these moments. That's why, like, is a 2-minute speech from a Palestinian speaker like that big of a deal?
She should have done that. Of course not.
But like, we embed it with extra significance. So the fact that, and I think that that Liz then getting the stage.
Not at the convention.
After not giving it. What's
not
that?
At the convention. She wasn't at the convention.
Not at the convention. It's important. But getting a stage.
So some things people don't remember. I just want to.
Which, you know what? If Kamala was like, look, the convention is booked. And I heard from DNC people that are like, that there were all these pedestrian reasons they couldn't do it. Because, people are going to want somebody. Or the Oregonians are going to want somebody. It's like, okay, fine. Then say, we'll do an event next week with her.
Sure.
And we'll go to Georgia together. You could do that and be like, oh, and the uncommitted folks be like, all right, you know what? Annoying that you can't find 2 minutes in this like endless affair, but okay, you're going to get on stage, then fine. Like that's something. But my point is like the second that Hassan, if you don't give Hassan anything to tell his audience and he still then comes and says, well, look, Trump's so bad. He then stops being the person that's going to influence them. Like he's now a different person. So now you need other more radical people to do the thing that you want them to do. So there's a reality to these people's like views of the conflict that aren't going to be changed by influencers. Influencers don't have the influence that we think. I think they then get it rejected by their audience.
I'm glad we did that. That was a 14-minute, I should put this behind the paywall, 14-minute sickos only bonus discourse over the DNC convention. All right, I appreciate you taking the extra time. My fighting list includes YIMBY. It includes other Middle Eastern policy stuff. It includes the investor houses, the big investor houses. I'm going to create a whole list for us. We'll just do a little, we'll figure something out.
It's on.
All right, Dropsite News. Everybody go support it. That's Ryan Grimm. We're back tomorrow. It's going to be a good one, I promise you. We'll see y'all then. Peace.
I've been wasted, angry and sad since you left Minneapolis. I wish my thoughts were pure like the driven snow.
Are you a fraud-paying American? One in four tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity fraud. With LifeLock, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Last year, billions in refunds were stolen. Could be from your salary, overtime, or second job. Gone. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Every year, people make the same fitness goal, train harder. But most fail because recovery gets ignored, especially connective tissue that muscles depend on to grow. Frog Fuel was developed by Navy SEALs and perfected by a Stanford-trained scientist, delivering 15 grams of nano-hydrolyzed collagen protein that digests in just 15 minutes. It's science-backed and ready to drink. No mixing, no sugar, no junk. This year, don't just train harder, recover smarter. Go to frogfuel.com. That's frogfuel.com. Stay unbreakable.